It is a Ben Fred Friday on ScoopsWithDannyMac.com and wherever you may be. Let's hope that you have had a safe holiday and you're recovering from your turkey or whatever food coma you may be in. This is presented by Henderson and Watercutty. Now, Henderson and Watercutty signed up last spring training. They're a couple of St. Louis guys that wanted to be affiliated with a St. Louis site. They reached out to me, and this has been a great partnership with those two individuals. They will help fight criminal charges in Missouri and Illinois, state, federal, and municipal courts. In addition to their criminal defense practice, they also assist people facing orders of protection, probation violations, sanctions by the nursing board, discipline by a college or university. Their number to call, they're available 24/7, even on holidays, 314-645-4400, 314-645-4400. And I've had people come up to me and say, hey, tell me a little bit about Henderson and Watercutty. You got a speeding ticket. I said, well, just go to the website. It's really easy, and you can navigate through that, and it's as easy as it possibly can be for you to answer your questions and to get the help you need, and that's at stlcriminaldefense.com. Well, Ben Fredrickson, Thanksgiving has come and gone, and hopefully you, sir, are out of your food coma.
Barely. Still shaking it off, but caffeinated and pushing through it. When you eat, see, I train for Thanksgiving all year round, and I eat like a slob all year in preparation for Thanksgiving, so that way you don't overdo it on Thanksgiving. See, it's called reverse. It's like reverse training for the holidays.
I think that's a smart move.
This is my peak season right here.
Yeah, you're in like, you know, mid season form, bro. This is great. You keep yourself in fabulous shape, Ben. We both know that.
Yeah.
Let's jump right into this. And I think the big news of the week, and for those that maybe are new to this, we try to look at the week that was and maybe a little bit the week ahead. But the big news, if you're a college fan and a sports fan of the college game, it affects you right here in the state of Missouri and so many Mizzou alum in St. Louis and across the Midwest. But here's Mizzou reporting themselves. They go to the NCAA, and it was bogus. It gets rejected, their appeal. So the postseason ban for football and other sports stays up. What was your reaction to this?
Well, I'm fortunate I was in Kansas City on Tuesday covering the Hall of Fame Classic, which is where the press conference was for the announcement that their appeal for the NCAA sanctions had been rejected. Now, this dates back, I mean, we're talking years. Jim Stirk was basically fresh on the job when Yolanda Kumar, a former athletic tutor, came forward and said, look, I did work on behalf of students. I took placement exams for players and blew the whistle on herself. So obviously that can't happen. That's wrong. And Missouri was faced with the question as to what does it do with this information. And Missouri did exactly what you're supposed to do after something that shouldn't happen happens. They took it to the NCAA. They took it to the SEC. They said, hey, this is bad. It happened. We know we're going to be punished for it. We'll cooperate with everything you guys need to do, and turned it over, hoping that, you know, they're raising the red flag and shining the spotlight on their own problem that had been discovered would be considered in the punishment. And that's kind of what the NCAA exists upon. It's cooperation. It's hoping that schools do the right thing when they find out something wrong has happened. So fast forward, Missouri gets hammered on the verdict. They expected to receive a scholarship. I'm sorry, they expected to be a vacation of wins where they have to give wins back, and they expected to be on probation. On top of that, they get hit with a postseason ban in three sports, basketball, baseball, and football, and scholarship restrictions, also recruiting limitations, and basically a big financial penalty, because if you don't go, if you're not eligible, if you're serving a postseason ban in football in the SEC, you miss out on, like, it's close to $10 million just because you don't get that cut of the SEC pie, and they do equal revenue sharing, and that's something that really caught them off guard. So they appealed it, and they liked their chances on the appeal, especially when a similar case, almost to the T, came out at Mississippi State, which was handled through a bit of a different process, a process that was not available to Missouri at the time their investigation started, a newer kind of cooperative a process that allows there to be more of almost an arbitration of penalties that let Mississippi State get off without a postseason ban. So Missouri felt good about it. And then, you know, 4 months later, the appeal comes out and they've been rejected. And I was really curious because Missouri took a stance after during its appeal that this was going to be a big subject in the ranks of the NCAA. And if you were going to get hammered with what they felt like was an overreaching penalty after cooperating, it was going to encourage schools not to cooperate. And I was curious to see how Jim Strick would handle that in Kansas City, if he was going to walk back those comments or kind of admit that he was just saber-rattling, but he didn't. The opposite of that. He doubled down. And this guy was been a kind of an NCAA servant for 30 years, Dan, and he said, look, the system's broken, and this is going to encourage schools to not do the right thing, and we need to create reform to change it. And, you know, this is going to be a problem for the NCAA. So it's one thing when we sit around and talk about the system being broken. It's another thing when an AD who's done it for 30 years says that. So I don't think the NCAA likes what Missouri is saying, but I don't think Missouri feels very good about the way it was handled here. And I think they've got a point.
I don't understand it. What was the general consensus among the media around there in Kansas City when this came down?
Well, I think the general consensus was, what is the point of an appeals committee if it can't overturn something like this, if it can't walk back something like this? When you compared the penalties that Missouri got to the case that was decided at Mississippi State, they're very similar, almost exactly the same, and Missouri gets a much more severe punishment. When you go back to the Notre Dame case that was decided previously, a little bit before the Mississippi State case, you had a student trainer who was doing work on behalf of football players. And Notre Dame was only hit then with all they had was vacated wins, no restrictions on scholarships, no restrictions on recruiting. They did not have to serve a postseason ban. They did not get hit with any sort of financial problem. They got probation, and they had to vacate a bunch of wins, which in their case isn't that big of a deal. In no case, it's really that big of a deal. You don't lose money for wins that were vacated in the past. So Missouri feels like it looks looking around and it's going, how does this happen to us? And, you know, I think the biggest frustration, because the most recent news was the appeal. The appeals committee pointed to this and said, we agree. There's some hard to explain discrepancies here in these different punishments. We agree that the membership, meaning the schools that are in the NCAA, need to clear up some of this confusion. But they did not feel, as the appeals committee, that it was their role to do that. And that was really frustrating for Mizzou. And I talked to Mike Glazier, the attorney who does a ton of these cases with schools when they get in trouble with the NCAA. And everyone I've talked to said that's the most confounding thing, is what is the point of the appeals committee if it's not their job to step in when they feel like something doesn't add up?
Let's continue the Mizzou conversation with what's happening on the basketball court. You mentioned that you covered Mizzou in Kansas City. They took on Oklahoma. They took on Butler. They lose both those games, and it really should be a home court advantage for the Missouri Tigers, and they lose those two games. Where's the program right now under Konzo Martin?
Yeah, that was a disappointing weekend for the Missouri basketball team, and talked to Konzo after it, and he's frustrated. We can make it as complicated as we need to or as simple as this. Missouri's not going to be very good if Jeremiah Tillman isn't locked in and playing well at both ends of the court, Dan. He's got it's one thing to say foul problems, but it's really not foul problems in terms that he's fouling out of a bunch of games. He's got a bad habit now, and this is not new for folks who've watched him over the course of his three-year career at Mizzou. If he gets those two early fouls, it's almost like he shuts down for the game, and he kind of checks out, and they've got to get him over the hump there. They either have to just play him and play him through and let him foul out in the first half, if that's what it takes, or get him to be effective if he battles some of that adversity. So if Mark Smith, who is one of their top three leading scorers, and Jeremiah Tillman are not playing effectively, then they're not going to be very good. And, you know, we can talk till we're blue in the face about Parker Brown looking a little bit better, and Drew Smith, I think, has been as good as advertised, the transfer from Evansville. But you're talking about two pretty important parts of this team, inside and outside, and Smith and Tillman, the most important being Tillman. And he had kind of a lost weekend there in Kansas City. The thing is Missouri's got to, if we can remove Tillman from the discussion, they've also just got to start better. Their defense is good, but it kind of builds as the game goes along. And both of these games, they were down 15-3 before they kind of got going. And that's just, they're not good enough to shoot themselves in the foot like that to start games against good teams. And they played two good teams.
Is this Barry Odom's final weekend with the Missouri Tigers as the head coach of the football program?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that, and I don't have someone telling me for sure that that's the truth, Dan, but I wouldn't be surprised. You know, people ask me how will this bowl ban situation, the rejected appeal, affect Barry Odom, and I think, this is my own personal opinion, I think it probably hurts him more than it helps him. Not that he had anything to do with any of the players who were affected by this, or not that he had, you know, this was not something that was his fault, but if Missouri was playing for a bowl game on Friday afternoon and they won that game, and then, you know, then you have the question of, okay, you've got a coach who's been to three consecutive bowl games. You have a coach who, you know, you'd like to have in place for those bowl practices. And there's a lot more reason to kind of say, okay, you know, this is a harder decision. Well, now you know you're not going. Now the game at Arkansas has become utterly meaningless against two disappointing teams, one of which has already fired their coach. You're not going to get a good read on this game. There's nothing that can happen, I don't think, win, lose, or draw on Friday that could move Jim Stirk toward keeping or getting rid of Barry Odom based on what he already knows. I mean, I don't think this game is going to affect his decision at all. So that would tell me that I don't know that he's made up his mind, but the body of work he's going to be evaluating, it probably doesn't mean that much to put Arkansas in it. I don't even know if Kelly Bryant's going to play in this game, Dan, later today. I think he's banged up. He's got all kinds of physical issues. He's been limited a bunch, probably more than we realize. I don't know if it makes a lot of sense for them to put him out there. So if he doesn't play, then it's even that much more of a crapshoot. Jim Stirk's got to decide here if Barry Odom has had enough time, if he likes the trend line of the program. But there's some numbers here that's going to be hard for him to square. His record against underdogs is unappealing. He has not reached up and knocked off top 25 teams very often. That's only happened one time. He's got a really, really bad record for a four-year coach against FBS teams that finish the year or have a winning record at this time. And those are things that I look for as, okay, this is starting to be a team that's reaching its potential. So, you know, Jim Stirk said one interesting thing in Kansas City. I don't know if it was a tell, but he was asked again about Odom and related to this ban. And he made a point to really kind of differentiate between the two, to kind of push back, not push back, but to kind of separate, hey, I'm upset with the way the team's being treated here by the NCAA, but I'm not ready to say that this is a reason the team has not succeeded on the field, which I think was maybe a tell. We'll see. We should know at the latest by Saturday which direction he's leaning here.
Yeah, you had some great numbers in your Ben Fred Fry 5 this past week. And again, we're visiting with Ben Fredrickson of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and this is presented by Henderson and Watercutty. See their services at stlcriminaldefense.com. After last Saturday's loss to Tennessee, Odom's overall winning percentage is down to below 500, 24-25. Under Odom, the Tigers have one win in 10 meetings against top 25 teams. Odom's Tigers have seven more losses than wins against SEC opponents since he took over for Gary Pinkel. They have lost 12 games to teams they were favored by Las Vegas to beat. And then under Odom, Mizzou has 19 more losses than wins against teams that finished their season with or at current winning records this season. That's not good. And when you mention, this is where I think, I always say this, follow the money in anything, right? Follow the dollars. But when you get the postseason ban, and you mentioned now that Mizzou is going to be out of that SEC postseason money, which is significant, and then you got a buyout. It's not huge with Barry Odom, but it's still money that goes to him that if he's not coaching the team, he's still going to get paid. I wonder how much the ban plays into what Odom has to deal with and Jim Stirk in trying to figure out this decision.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that people probably don't spend enough time talking about because it very much affects things. And it's one thing to holler for, you know, go hire this coach. Well, you know, if you don't have the money, then that's not happening. Missouri has to be realistic about what it can spend. Jim Stirk has to have an idea of what he's going to get from donors and boosters and people who would step up if he decided he needed to make a change. Got to remember, he tapped a lot of those folks for that end zone renovation project. So Missouri does not have a deep, wide base of donors who are giving mega millions of dollars to the university's athletic department. It's not, you know, it ranks among the last teams. It is on the bottom floor of the SEC in terms of donor base for its athletics program. So, you know, to compare this to a Florida State situation where everybody's throwing money at Willie Taggart's buyout after a blip of a start there, then that's not what happens at Missouri. It just isn't. So what does he have Who does he have in his corner if he decides to make that change? One thing I thought was interesting was that I think, and I don't know this for sure, but I think Missouri has budgeted for this bowl hit when the sanctions came out. In worst-case scenario, I think they knew they had to be in a position to keep moving, even if that didn't happen. The other thing, too, was that they are going to get some money from the university. Alex Cartwright, the Missouri chancellor, made that clear at the press conference that they're going, the university side will basically give the athletics department a loan to help get through this a little bit, which will be repaid. But also, that made me wonder if there's maybe a little more money than some previously thought if he decides to make a change. It's not just Odom's salary that has to be bought out, it's his staff. And he's got some high-paid assistants. His salary does not rank as high as some of his assistants. I mean, he gets paid more, but if you look at where the assistant pay ranks among the league, he's got some high-paid assistants like a Derek Dooley who would obviously be going out too if Odom got shown the door. So there's some money there, and then you have to go figure out what you could pay the next coach. I mean, if you're going to pay the next guy $3 million, then you better be convinced he's going to be better. I mean, you get what you pay for kind of league. And, you know, if you're going to try to raise the profile of the coaching position, which is what Missouri did in basketball when it went and got Konzo Martin after the Kim Anderson experiment didn't work out, then you're going to have to pay more. So where's all this money going to come from if people have it all figured out? That's a good question, and it's one that probably, levels expectations a little bit. And I'll say this too, Dan, like, it's hard for me to – I'm certainly not rooting for Barry Odom to go. I don't think there's anybody who can have that job who wants to win more than he does. He played there. He lives and dies with each loss, and I think he's a good leader, and his players want to run through a wall for him, and they love him. But it is hard for me to look at a four-year body of work and look at some of the penalties that have happened for this team over the course of the season, look at some of the problems with the offense. And Barry doesn't coach the offense, but he did hire Derek Dooley, a guy who's never called plays before. And the offense ran into a wall this year. It wasn't just on Kelly Bryant. They had failure across multiple levels of that offense. And then there were times their defense gave away too. So I just don't see enough signs across this football team over the course of the season to say, okay, you know, this is absolutely moving in the right direction. So Sterk is the only guy whose opinion matters, but there does seem to be enough discussion, especially this weekend in Kansas City, that made you wonder if he's thinking of getting his own guy in there.
I am proud to add to the website, as an exclusive sponsor of Ben Fred Fridays, the St. Louis-based criminal defense firm of Henderson Watercutty. As many of you know, I'm proud to be from St. Louis, and Mick Henderson and Steve Watercutty are from St. Louis. They call it home. Their firm is the premier criminal defense firm in Missouri and Illinois. So being from St. Louis, they want to help people from our region. And all you have to do is go to their website, stlcriminaldefense.com. That's stlcriminaldefense.com. Now, on that website, you will see the countless testimonials of people who they have helped over the many years that they have been doing work for people in the region. On the site, there are frequently asked questions, categories, and a wealth of information to help guide you through the process of figuring out how to make decisions to protect your rights. And it doesn't matter how big or small the case. They're known for their communication with their clients. And this is why you can reach them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they have a proven track record of handling your criminal defense and traffic needs. The St. Louis-based criminal defense firm of Henderson Watercutty. The website again. And really, go to the website. It's incredibly easy to navigate. stlcriminaldefense.com. Check it out. That's stlcriminaldefense.com. Or call them anytime, day or night, 24 hours a day. The number, 314-645-4400. 314-645-4400. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.
Well, staying with the college scene, SLU goes on the road. Their first road game, they go to Boston College, a team from the ACC, and a road win. They're now 6-1. They've got Southern Illinois Sunday at Chaffetz Arena at 3 o'clock, and we'll have the game on Fox Sports Midwest. You know, this is what you kind of expected from SLU. I mean, there were some dangerous games in there, non-conference schedule, and still, you know, there's some tough ones to go. But at this point in the season, if you're Travis Ford, you know, you looked at Seton Hall and you thought, that's going to be really tough. I mean, you had them at home, but they've got a pro on that team. They've got a veteran team. I can handle that. But going on the road, winning a BC, and then doing what they've done against a couple of teams at home that are tough tests, they may not get the eye test of the casual basketball fan, but those that follow it closely know that there are good teams. I think if you're SLU and Chris May and Travis Ford, you got to be, I don't know, thrilled is the right word, but you got to be pleased with the way that things have started out for the Billikens.
Yeah, absolutely, and they're not telling the players that, mind you, but yeah, I think they feel good about this start. And I think Travis has to feel good about the response since the Seton Hall game. I was at that game. It wasn't pretty. They did not start well, and they were really never really in it. But, you know, that's one of those games where I think you can. There's two ways you can respond. You can either kind of go into the dumps about it, or you can realize, hey, we got challenged and we weren't ready, but let's be ready the next time it comes. And I think that's kind of more of what you've seen from SLU. And that Boston College game, that's a nice win. A nice win on the resume, one a nice one that the tournament committee can look at later on, that true road game and a good win, a good pickup that against a team that I think is better maybe than some people realize. So a confidence builder for sure. I love what Hassan French is doing, man. He's a dynamic player. I don't know if we're going to see him play in the pros. I think we have a chance to maybe see him if he's up for it. I think he could play in the NFL. I really do think that.
I do too.
He's such a gifted athlete. He reminds me of like Antonio Gates or Tony Gonzalez. I got to think NFL scouts would be drooling over the idea of converting him to football, but he's just such a strong, impossible to guard guy. I like the composure of this team. I think Jordan Goodwin's a really good leader. I love his on the court leadership. I see one thing that he does that some people would call it corny, but I don't care. I think it's telling. When something bad happens to him, when he gets called for a foul he doesn't like, or a turnover that was close, or he felt like it wasn't fair, he's the first guy to start clapping and going to pick up his teammates, getting their heads back in it. Not somebody doesn't have to do that to him. He does it to them, and I think that's a really good sign for kind of the way this team is thinking and the way and its toughness. I still think that they've got to figure out that free throw thing.
Absolutely,
I harp on it a lot, but they're giving away so many points there. They get to the free throw line a ton, so that helps to kind of square the percentage, but I don't know if they can fix it. I would think they would have done it by now, but any signs of improvement there would be a really big boost to their chances to be a special team.
I had an interview with Ted Simmons on the website last week. It's gotten a lot of play. It's gotten a lot of attention, which is great. He'll be up again for the Veterans Committee. He was one vote shy of the Hall of Fame. We get into that. We get into Yadier Molina. We get into being a scout, front office, coaching. His time with the Cardinals. It's a very compelling interview at scoopswithdannymack.com. I know you wrote about it at the Post-Dispatch. I appreciate that. He, I think, has to be in. I gave compelling numbers that I looked up at the beginning of the interview, and you can listen to that. And I also want to ask you about Larry Walker and what you're hearing from maybe your baseball writer counterparts. He was at, I believe, 54.6% of the vote last time. He's on the ballot for the final time, and he's got to get to 75%. Just your thoughts on both those guys moving forward and a chance at what is immortality in baseball's Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I thought your interview with Ted Simmons was eye-opening. I've had a chance to talk with him a little bit. I sat by him at one of the baseball writers' dinner a couple years ago, and that was one of the thrills for me. He's such a laid-back, kind of just cerebral guy, and having a chance to kind of just hear him talk about the game and talk to the players about the game. And your interview captured a lot of it. And what he said about this notion of making the Hall of Fame or not, it's easy to say, but it's a lot harder to actually live that way. And he had that line about saying, look, if I were to get mad about not making the Hall of Fame, it would be disrespectful to this great career I've had in the game. And he really means it. And that's so genuine. And I wish at times that he would campaign for himself more. It seems like sometimes these guys go on these tours to make the Hall of Fame, and it's helping their case. And he's not probably going to be the guy who does that, but the numbers should speak for themselves. And he was so close last year, one vote away. I think, based off of just what I'm seeing on Twitter, it seems like it seems like people want it to happen. Now, we can't speak for the Veterans Committee. We know sometimes they make decisions that are a bit odd to the general baseball public, and it changes every year. So I don't think you ever feel confident, especially when it's taken him this long to get in. But I do hope that him being one vote away last year have opened some eyes. And, you know, there is kind of something about last ballot thing, too, talking about Larry Walker. That does seem to generate a discussion and kind of create its own momentum for certain guys. So I hope he gets that bump. I know that, you've done a lot to try to open eyes to him. And there does seem to be a lot of people now, kind of this new age of writers who are getting more chances to vote and becoming more of a presence in the voting. They seem to be pro Larry Walker, from what I can tell.
I would agree. And I think they take a harder look sabermetrically at him. Yeah. And I also think they take a harder look at Larry and his numbers outside of Coors Field, because I think the easy narrative is to say, well, he played at Coors and, you know, there was no humidor. And yeah, I mean, there's certainly something to that. But there was a number of at-bats that were not at Coors Field, and he put up incredible numbers, was a great base runner, one of the best defensive players I've ever seen. So I would hope they'd give more credence to that. Let's wrap it up with this. The Blues are rolling. Is it far-fetched at this point to say that Jordan Bennington should be considered as an MVP candidate? I mean, this guy, they have solid defense. Don't get me wrong. The defensive core in front of him is very good, but they're losing Sundquist. They've lost others that are out with injury. They had the Fabry deal. There's been some knocks to this team, and yet they're rolling after being in the Stanley Cup final and winning the championship a year ago. And a lot of it has to do with number 50. I'm just a big believer that it starts between the pipes and then you build out. And to me, this guy is one of the best players right now in the world. There's no other way to put it. He's been that good for the St. Louis Blues.
Well, at this rate, he's going to be the only player left.
Probably right.
My God, when you think of what they've lost, you know, three of their top 12 forwards and then Sundquist, you know, it's been they're in survival mode. Now, they're not exactly playing like it. It's been remarkable they've been able to, you know, continue to build ground, let alone just, you know, try to stay afloat with these guys out. You know, big names. We're talking, you know, Steen, Tarasenko for the whole season. You know, Sundquist had been playing so much, better. It just keeps happening. And then you throw in a guy like Sammy Blay, who, you know, probably did not get as much of a splash as it deserved for him being out. He led the team in hits by like 20. You know, he's the kind of guy that Berube, I think, you know, wants to just clone. He's all over the place, feisty player, and all these guys keep dropping, and the guy who's back there trying to hold it all together is Jordan Bennington. So, yes, Dan, I think that's a fair conversation, especially if the Blues stay in it through this injury wave. They're going to probably, at some point, reality's going to hit here. You can't lose this many players and not dip. The question is, how can they limit it? How can they kind of hold the line until they start to get some of these guys back? And that depth that they use to get all the way to the Stanley Cup is going to have to help them now. The other thing that helps is having a guy who doesn't allow more than, you know, a goal a night or a goal here and there. And Bennington's that good. I think one of the things that's really stood out this year is he plays his best against the best teams.
Yes.
Which is really a good sign when it comes to, you know, trying to figure out what this team will look like when it makes the playoffs. And the other thing, too, and it's taboo to say, but I think Jake Allen has played well. And I don't know, you know, if the goal is to keep him forever as the backup, or if, you know, maybe at some point a team starting goalie goes down and the Blues look to kind of get some depth or some you know, injury reserves in by trading him for a desperate team, desperate for a goalie. But it speaks a lot to Jake Allen that he's played well enough to be in that conversation if it does happen. And it speaks to Jordan Bennington that the idea of trading the backup goalie does not scare many people, because Jordan Bennington has done nothing to suggest that what we saw last year was not who he is. And there was all that discussion this offseason about can he do it again, and was that a fluke? He's not fluky. He plays best against the best teams. His style is repeatable. It's nothing that's, you know, it's just contained and it's deliberate and it shows up every night. And when he does allow a goal, he shakes it off and forgets about it. I mean, all these things are repeatable. I don't think we're talking about a guy who's going to crumble all of a sudden anymore.
I would completely agree. Ben, happy Thanksgiving to you and your lovely wife and your family. And we'll catch you up next Friday.
Say, sir, man. Sounds good. You too. And we'll do it again soon.